Spain, Norway, and Ireland say they're recognizing a Palestinian state.
Europe would say, look, that's a process. We now think that the first step has to be putting the two-state solution back on the table, and everything else needs to follow from that.
Plus, shelling continues in Ukraine's east.
Russian forces continue the shelling of the Kharkiv region and the city of Kharkiv, and are trying to take the city of Vovchansk under their full control.
And later, a look at Kenyan President William Ruto's trip to Washington and French President Emmanuel Macron's very different trip to New Caledonia. Today is Wednesday, May 22nd, and this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. A big day diplomatically as three European countries say they are officially recognizing a state of Palestine. They say peace can come only through a two-state solution, and that must begin with recognizing a Palestinian state. Israel rejects this, saying that recognition of a Palestinian state following the actions of Hamas on October 7th is simply rewarding terrorism. The AP's Charles de Ledesma has the details.
Norway, Ireland, and Spain say they're recognizing a Palestinian state in a historic move. Norway's Prime Minister, Jonas Gahr Støre, said the Scandinavian country will officially recognize a Palestinian state as of May 28. Irish Prime Minister Simon Harris said on Wednesday his country is coordinating with Spain and Norway an historic and important day for Palestine. Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez said his country will recognize the state on May 28 too. Gahr Støre said that there cannot be peace in the Middle East if there's no recognition. Israel's foreign minister, Israel Katz, has ordered Israel's ambassadors from Ireland and Norway to immediately return to Israel. He spoke before Spain's announcement. Katz says Ireland and Norway intend to send a message today to the Palestinians and the whole world. Terrorism pays. Katz adds the recognition could impede efforts to return Israel's hostages being held in Gaza and makes a ceasefire less likely by, he emphasizes, rewarding the jihadists of Hamas and Iran. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Meanwhile, in Washington, a spokesperson for the National Security Council tells VOA that President Joe Biden is, quote, a strong supporter of a two-state solution and has been throughout his career. He believes a Palestinian state should be realized through direct negotiations between the parties and not through unilateral recognition. For his part, Riyad Mansour, the Palestinian ambassador to the UN, was emotional as he addressed reporters in New York.
And it is a wonderful omen as we assemble today that we received very positive news from Europe that Spain, Ireland, and Norway declared today that they will be recognizing the state of Palestine on the 28th of this month. This European wave, hopefully, will be followed by other waves. The support to the state of Palestine, its admission to the UN and recognition is taking momentum after what we did in the Security Council and what we did in the General Assembly. The state of Palestine deserves to be a full member state in the United Nations. Thank you.
So what does all this mean? Do three announcements of recognition in Europe change anything for the people of Gaza? For a closer look, I'm joined by Stacey Goddard. She's a professor of political science and director of the Madeleine K. Albright Institute at Wellesley College in Massachusetts. She says the move is largely symbolic, but still very important.
A lot of the effects here have to do with saying that regardless of what's going on the ground, regardless of Israel's efforts in Gaza, that this community, this European community, continues to be committed to finding a two-state solution. It's not going to change, for example, anything at the United Nations in terms of Palestine status as a non-member observer. All of that has to go through the United Nations Security Council, and my guess is at this point that the United States would continue to veto. But it's not going to have any sort of measurable impact on the ground here. So to kind of sum up, You know, I think it's important. Symbolic moves are important. And certainly Israel's taking the symbolic move is important, but it's not going to change things on the ground right yet.
So the Israelis are saying that by recognizing Palestinian statehood, you're rewarding terrorism. Is there anything to that argument?
I don't think so. I think that this is, you know, Israel is adopting some hardline rhetoric. I think they see this as a move to push them into a corner. And they certainly see this as a move to take negotiations more seriously, to actually find a hostage agreement, to find a ceasefire and or at least a temporary end to this conflict. In terms of what they're saying, though, first of all, it completely ignores the fact that, you know, there are actually two governing entities in Palestine, one of which is Hamas in the Gaza Strip, and the other which just continues to be the Palestinian Authority. And the Palestinian Authority hasn't been effective probably in the last decade, but it is still a governing authority in the West Bank. So that obviously when Israel's ministers are saying this, they're completely ignoring this kind of dual split in the governance of Palestine.
Well, would seem like the European leaders are also ignoring this. I mean, they're not saying they recognize the Palestinian Authority or Hamas. They're just saying they recognize the state of Palestine. So who are they recognizing?
I think that's kind of a kick the can down the road moment, right? I don't think there's any sort of sense that they're recognizing Hamas. I think if anybody asks them if they're recognizing Hamas, you know, as a legitimate authority, I think ultimately they would say that that's the call of the Palestinian people. And they would probably also note that the Palestinian people, even within Gaza, they haven't had an opportunity to elect those leaders since 2007. They, you know, recent, very just right before October 7th, public opinion data that came out of Gaza suggested that Hamas is not the government that a majority would choose, right? Which, again, isn't to say that the Palestinian Authority is, but it's to say that Hamas doesn't have some sort of solid, legitimate claim to governance in the region, right? So I think that Europe would say, look, that's a process. We now think that the first step has to be putting the two-state solution back on the table, and everything else needs to follow from that.
So in the United Nations, there's roughly 192, 193 countries, 142 of them now, I believe, or maybe it's 143, are recognizing a state of Palestine. And as you said, the reason why it's not becoming a state in the United Nations is because the U.S. will veto it in the Security Council. At what point does this become a political problem globally for the United States?
I think it already is a political problem globally for the United States, that it consistently has to rely on its veto power in order to try to push forward what it continues to see, the U.S. continues to see, I think, as its core vision, that you don't get a meaningful two-state solution unless it is negotiated with the Israeli government. So I think basically what's going on globally is a more and more unified message that a lot of countries don't see the potential for an Israeli government that is willing to act as a partner, right? And so the increasing question of if that is the case, what do you do, right? Can you impose something from the outside? Can you at the very least get this into, lack of a better term, a frozen conflict moment where you can get a lot more international and regional support? Right. But I think that for the United States, there still is a hope there will be a partner there. But what happens if the rest of the world stops believing this? I think that puts the United States in a very difficult position.
Professor Stacey Goddard is a professor at Wellesley College in Massachusetts. Dr. Goddard, thanks for taking the time to be with us. Thanks for your analysis today.
Thank you so much for the conversation.
And In other international diplomatic news about Israel, Secretary of State Antony Blinken told lawmakers on Tuesday that the International Criminal Court's announcement that it's seeking an arrest warrant for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu endangers hopes for a ceasefire in Gaza. Blinken's testimony comes as progressives criticize the Biden administration over its support for Israel. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more.
The International Criminal Court's announcement that global arrest warrants will be sought for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar on war crimes allegations drew bipartisan criticism on Capitol Hill Tuesday. Senator Ben Cardin is the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee.
I see as a step in the wrong direction that's going to make it more challenging for us to get the parties together. There's always been an understanding the ICC is there to deal with countries that don't have an independent judiciary. Israel has an independent judiciary.
The United States top diplomat says the ICC announcement complicates negotiations for a ceasefire in the conflict that began October 7th when Hamas attacked Israel, killing more than 1,200 people and taking about 250 hostages. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken.
The shameful equivalence implied between Hamas and the leadership of Israel, I think that only complicates the prospects for getting such an agreement. We'll continue to forge ahead to do that. But that decision, as you said, on so many levels, is totally wrongheaded.
Other lawmakers downplayed the announcement. Democratic Senator Tim Kaine.
A prosecutor making a recommendation, I think, is not worth the attention this is getting.
Protesters interrupting Blinken's testimony.
Blinken, you will be remembered as the butcher of Gaza.
As part of the domestic disagreement over U.S. support of Israel. More than 35,000 Palestinians, both civilians and combatants, have died in the conflict, according to the Hamas-run Gaza Health Ministry. A recent State Department report found Israel has likely violated international standards for preventing harm to civilians, but the U.S. has not cut off aid. Again, Secretary of State Blinken.
We are investigating a number of instances, some of which are alluded to in the report, others that are not, to make those determinations. Israel itself is investigating hundreds of incidents to make its own determinations. And indeed, there are criminal investigations underway in Israel in this area. It's very difficult to make final determinations in the midst of a war when we do not have access on the ground.
Democrats warned Blinken the world was watching the U.S. response. Senator Chris Van Hollen.
What is painfully obvious to anybody paying attention, that for long periods of time, between October 7th and today, the Netanyahu government has failed to comply with the international norms that require it to facilitate and not arbitrarily restrict or deny the delivery of humanitarian assistance to people in desperate need. Mr. Secretary, that hurts our credibility around the world.
Meanwhile, the top Senate Foreign Relations Republican, Jim Risch, said the U.S. was not doing enough to support Israel.
The administration is imposing costs on Israel. You must stop blaming Israel and let Israel remove Hamas from Gaza. That is the only way to move forward.
The United Nations announced Tuesday it was no longer able to access aid operations in Rafah. Blinken told lawmakers the U.S. has warned Israel its offensive in the region could be deeply harmful to civilians. Catherine Gibson, VOA News.
And now to Ukraine, where the situation on the front lines in the Kharkiv and Donetsk regions remains extremely difficult. Meanwhile, the European Commission announced that Ukraine will soon receive the first allotment of money from frozen Russian assets. VOA correspondent Anna Chernikova has the details from Kyiv.
Pokrovsky napryamok ta inchi Donetsky napryamky, Kramatorsky.
In his evening address, President Zelensky reported that the situation on the front line in the Kharkiv and Donetsk regions remains very difficult with ongoing heavy battles and intensive shelling. Russian forces continue the shelling of the Kharkiv region and the city of Kharkiv and are trying to take the city of Vovchansk under their full control. According to the latest update from the Ukrainian military, the city is 50% under Ukrainian and 50% under Russian control. According to the Kharkiv local military administration, there are still 100 people in the city of Vovchansk who were taken hostage by the Russian forces and cannot be evacuated under the threat of being shot. Russian forces are trying to create a 10-kilometer buffer zone on the Ukrainian territory along the border with Russia. In the early hours of May 22, Russian forces conducted a drone attack on the energy facilities in Shostka and Konotop in the Sumy region with drones. As a result of the attack, the electricity was cut off in the city of Sumy, the power supply is currently being restored. In total, Ukrainian air defense destroyed 24 drones within the Mykolaiv, Dnipropetrovsk, Zaporizhia, Donetsk, Sumy and Odessa regions. Ukrainian energy officials said that the overall energy situation in Ukraine will remain very difficult and that Ukrainians should prepare for power outages in winter, not just in summer, as electricity consumption will increase when temperatures go lower. Meanwhile, the European Commission announced on Tuesday that Ukraine will receive the first money from the frozen Russian assets in July 2024. The total amount is expected to be about 2.53 billion euros. In 2024, 90% of the funds will be devoted to the supply of military equipment through the assistance measures funded under the European Peace Facility and 10% for the EU budget. Within the share of the EU budget in 2024, the full allocation will be devoted to the Ukraine Facility Mechanism, a four-year program of providing economic assistance to Ukraine. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. William Ruto, the president of Kenya, will arrive in Washington for a state visit later on Wednesday. We'll take a look at what to expect in a few minutes. But first, President Emmanuel Macron of France will be traveling soon, too. But he will likely see a frostier reception than Ruto will. Macron is headed to the South Pacific Island and French overseas territory of New Caledonia. His trip comes after deadly riots and protests after a new law that changes some of the voting rules, giving more voting rights to the non-native French on the island over the objections of the native Canuck people. Reuters' Ryan Chang has that story.
Australian military planes landed in New Caledonia on Tuesday, evacuating citizens from the French overseas territory. That's after deadly riots erupted on the island last week, sparked by new voting rules introduced by Paris.
New Zealand is doing evacuations too, with media reports saying some 50 people have safely arrived in Auckland.
While over 100 Australians and other tourists had safely landed in Brisbane on Tuesday, according to Australian Foreign Minister Penny Wong on X. Mining worker Chris Salmon was among the evacuees.
Happy just to see my family and relieved. But yeah, like I was saying before, it's quite sad what's going on over there. It feels all pretty awful and pretty senseless. So,
France says around 3,200 people were waiting to leave or enter New Caledonia as commercial flights were halted due to the unrest. The authorities say more flights are expected this week to evacuate some 500 French and foreign tourists from the island. Meanwhile, French President Emmanuel Macron announced plans to travel to New Caledonia late on Tuesday. Speaking after a cabinet meeting, French government spokesperson Prisca Thévenot said Macron would set up a mission. She said it was part of efforts to restore order.
This return to calm is happening. The situation is not completely normalized, but it is improving. It's clear to us that much remains to be done before returning to normal.
Officials say the president will meet with local representatives in New Caledonia on Thursday to talk about politics and reconstruction. Dialogue may not be easy, however, with many pro-independence leaders blaming the riots on Macron pushing through the electoral reform, despite local opposition. Violence on the island has led to looted shops, torched cars, and road barricades. Indigenous Kanak people were angered by reforms that would allow French nationals who've lived in New Caledonia for more than 10 years to take part in elections. Local leaders fear the change will dilute the Kanak vote.
That's Ryan Chang of Reuters reporting for us today. And now we go back to Washington and the upcoming state visit of Kenyan President William Ruto. VOA's Anita Powell has more.
The White House gave VOA its three reasons for choosing Kenya's president to break the nearly 16-year drought during which no African leader has been honored with a state visit. These include the two governments' shared democratic convictions and their like-minded approach in leveraging the private sector. The primary reason, the administration's new top Africa policymaker told VOA, is Kenya's recent decision to assert itself globally by offering 1,000 security officers for Haiti. Francis Brown is Senior Director for African Affairs at the National Security Council.
We chose Kenya for a few reasons. Number one is the Kenya-U.S. partnership has really grown from a regionally focused one to a globally focused one. So we've been really pleased the way the Kenyans have stepped up to play leadership beyond their region.
Analysts say a state visit is a big deal. Cameron Hudson is a senior fellow in the Africa program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
It is the highest diplomatic honor that our president can bestow. It is typically an indicator of a very close and important bilateral relationship. And so elevating Kenya to the level of, let's say, a Japan, which was the most recent country to have a state visit, I think is symbolic. And it's important for all the reasons that I just described, as far as Kenya being on a level that we would give it the same, privileges as one of our oldest and longest security partners.
Brown said the administration aims to use the visit to reach agreements in areas like technology, climate management, debt relief, and health. And on the Haiti security mission, Washington has signaled its approval with a $300 million pledge of support. Brown again.
We've been working really closely with them. As you may know, there's been planning underway for a number of months. It's included policing experts from around the world working to develop a concept of operations. Kenya's not going it alone.
Kenyan President William Ruto, on his first stop in Atlanta, said he'd prioritize the need for American help in restructuring the debts of African nations, many of them to China, the world's largest creditor. But human rights advocates in Nairobi told VOA they hope American leadership will also raise concerns over abuses by Kenyan police, who are taking the lead in the Haiti mission. They also shared fears around proposed legislation they say threatens sexual minorities and a decline in media freedoms. Irungu Houghton is executive director for Amnesty International Kenya.
We, first of all, see this as a really excellent opportunity to focus on governance, human rights, and the rule of law for many reasons. Both the United States and Kenya are nations that have projected themselves as essentially, nations that believe in these values. And the state dinner is an opportunity really to focus on that.
All this drama playing on this stage on Thursday. Anita Powell, VOA News, the White House.
And for a closer look at that state dinner, here's the AP's Washington correspondent, Sagar Meghani.
White House executive chef Chris Comerford and executive pastry chef Susie Morrison are the first women in those jobs. Bill Yassis worked with both while executive pastry chef in the George W. Bush and Obama administrations. State dinners are a high honor reserved for top allies, and the food planning takes months with a few different menu proposals, tastings, and dry runs.
We're not trying anything out. By that time, it's probably been rehearsed three or four times.
Some of it depends on what the guest wants. Yassis remembers China's Xi Jinping asking for a very American menu in 2015.
Which I think was a polite way for him to say that he didn't think we could do Chinese food very well.
The menu featured Maine lobster and Colorado lamb. I'm Sagar Meghani.
And that's going to wrap it up for today. There is more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts.
Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.